Today, now it's getting very real, the DFA Daily for the 14th of April 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Analysis Post, covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The initial phony war regarding the economic impacts of the current health issues is passing as more data emerges. The latest from the Australian Treasury today indicates that unemployment is set to soar to its highest rate in almost three decades, with 1.4 million Australians expected to be out of work. The new Treasury figures forecast that the jobless rate will double in the June quarter from 5.1% to 10%, all but confirming that Australia will enter a recession as it deals with the pandemic. It will be the first time the unemployment rate has hit double digits since April 1994, and the figure is a fraction below Australia's peak unemployment rate of 11.2% back in 1992. But Treasury's estimates show that the unemployment rate would have been much higher and peaked at around 15% had not the government intervened with the $130 billion wage subsidy program known as JobKeeper. Now, given that they were targeting 6 million potential workers with support, and there are around 2 million workers in addition not eligible, we would not be surprised to see the figure go even higher. And as we discussed already, the Roy Morgan data, though on a different basis, certainly confirms a rise up 9.5% to 16.8%. This is probably a better, more current measure. One issue is that the official ABS data will be late to the party, with the next round of data only running to the start of March. We'll have to wait for the following month's series to get a true sounding. But we might be able to read across from Canada, who released more current data and revealed that there the unemployment rate jumped from 5.6% to 7.8% in just 1 month. And with more to come as their lockdown continues to bite. As Treasurer Frydenberg said in a statement, the economic shock facing the global economy from the virus is far more significant than what was seen during the global financial crisis over a decade ago. And the Grattan Institute blog makes the point that the Australian government's fiscal response so far amounts to, wait for it, more than $7,700 per Australian. And this does not include about $15 billion worth of measures by state and territory governments. The federal government's economic response now totals $193.9 billion. Add $3.5 billion in health spending, $2.4 billion and $1.1 billion, and the federal government has budgeted almost $200 billion against the crisis so far. Only a few weeks ago, those sums would have seemed incredible, but Australia is far from alone in breaking spending records. Australia's announced measures to date represent 9.5% of GDP. At the top of the table is the United States at 9.9%. Japan is at 6.7%. New Zealand, the United Kingdom and Canada have all committed more than 4.5% of GDP. Of the Commonwealth spending, $39 billion will support businesses and $25 billion will flow to households. But most of the Commonwealth spending, $130 billion, is channeled through businesses to households in the form of the JobKeeper wage subsidy. Australia is in good company in putting a wage subsidy package at the centre of its fiscal responses. Many countries, including New Zealand, Canada, United States and the United Kingdom, have all announced packages that provide government-funded income support via businesses to partially replace lost income for workers and to maintain employment relationships. The design of the packages varies a lot, but a key reason Australia has so far budgeted more for its virus response is because it has committed to funding the JobKeeper program and higher levels of support through the welfare system for 6 months, whereas other countries have budgeted for shorter periods. The US has funded its wage subsidy program so far for 8 weeks, and New Zealand, Canada and the UK for 3 months. It's likely that many of these countries will need to extend their programs and so spend significantly more. If their wage subsidy programs were to be extended to 6 months, we can show what that additional spending for some of those countries would be if their wage subsidy programs were to be extended to 6 months. The Australian government may need to extend its program too, but it has provided valuable certainty to business and households by committing upfront to a 6-month scheme. If the shutdowns and spatial distancing measures extend beyond a few months, the fiscal commitments of governments around the world will have to grow. Most of the responses so far have focused on mitigating the immediate economic fallout, keeping businesses and workers in the shutdown industries afloat. But as the crisis drags on, the second round effects will hit almost every part of the economy, increasing the need for government spending support. When the health crisis eventually eases, governments will need to look to more traditional stimulus measures, household payments, investment incentives, social and physical infrastructure spending to rebuild their economies. The only certainty here is that record-breaking international spending commitments in response to the virus are only going to get larger. And today, National Australia Bank's Index of Business Conditions plunged down 21 points in March, compared with 1 point expected and zero movement last month. The survey's volatile measure of business confidence crashed down 66 points in March, compared with down 2 points as expected and down 4 points seen back in February. The gauge fell to the lowest in the history of the series. NAB's Group Chief Economist Alan Oster said worryingly, but not surprisingly, businesses' outlook is the weakest ever. Businesses have essentially told us that trading conditions, profitability and employment all went backwards in a big way in the month. We expect a recession of unprecedented speed and magnitude for the Australian economy over the next 3 quarters. This will see a sharp increase in unemployment. Both confidence and conditions declined this month after a period of stabilisation in conditions, though it appears too early to fully quantify the effect of the virus, with around 60% of firms reporting no impact to date. That is surprisingly small, they say, but it will clearly deteriorate going forward. Even so, confidence is now firmly negative, and business conditions appear to have renewed its previous downward trend, with both series well below long-term averages. More importantly, forward orders deteriorated significantly and is quite negative. The notable decline in recruitment and personal confidence over the past 2 months, a decline in exports, and the overall softening in forward orders, in part reflecting weaker confidence, are all areas that would have been expected to show its impact. More broadly, the survey continues to suggest ongoing softness in the business sector, with conditions and confidence having tracked below average for some time and capacity utilisation hovering around recent averages. This has been reflected in reported CapEx falling to a below average level after trending lower over the past 18 months or so, and the employment index ticked up in the month and is back around its long run average despite the ongoing weakness in confidence, trading conditions and profitability. However, while it remains a bright spot in the survey, it too has moderated and implies a significantly slower pace of growth in employment when compared with 2018 and early 2019. In other words, there is more bad news to come. By state, the decline in business conditions was relatively uniform, consistent with the relatively uniform shutting down of businesses. Readings for March were Queensland, minus 19, New South Wales and Western Australia, minus 20, South Australia, minus 21, Victoria, minus 27, and Tasmania, down minus 28. By industry, conditions understandably vary. Recreation and personnel, most impacted by social distancing, fell to minus 48, whereas wholesale posted a plus 6 rise, boosted by brisk sales of groceries and office furniture for those working at home. Transport and utilities were minus 15, with other reports that public transport patronage in Sydney is down by 75% to the lowest level in a century. Retail was down 16, finance and business and property down 14, and manufacturing reported down 21, which, by the way, is at odds with the Australian Interest Group's PMI, which actually rose to 53.7 in March on the back of increased demand for manufactured food, groceries and personal care items. Construction, an essential industry, has changed little and is sitting at minus 3. Mining fell to minus 42, with the world economy sliding into a deep recession and prices for some commodities, notably oil, moving lower. And preliminary auction results from CoreLogic reveal that across the combined capital cities, a very subdued 636 homes were scheduled for auction over the Easter weekend, and so far 472 results have been collected, and that returned a primary auction clearance rate of 29.3%, dragged down by a withdrawal rate of 57%. As the auction market continues to face challenges around social distancing measures, banning on-site auctions. Of the sold results this week, 63% were sold prior to the scheduled auction date. Now, of course, this is always a slow weekend given the Easter break, but this is something more substantive. And again, we are seeing auctions from earlier transactions being counted and the absolute volumes falling. The final results will be even worse. Now, last week, the AFR reported that Australia's lower density and predisposition towards detached housing has played an important role in keeping the death rate from the virus relatively low in Australia. Just look at the streetscape of cities and towns in Italy and compare it to the average Australian suburban streetscape. The difference is obvious. Professor Gary Gellhol, Executive Director of the Western Australian Health Translation Network, said, "It's so much easier to isolate jurisdictions here. All you need to do is to put a police car on the road linking them," he said. The difference in density is one of the several factors behind Australia's low death rates. But then this was immediately countered by the real estate spruikers at Domain, which brought out a whole series of lobbyists to spread the propaganda that high-density living should not be feared, it improves living standards and is in fact healthy for us all. Living in high-density cities gives people better overall health outcomes and should not be feared, experts say. The advantage of more dense neighbourhoods is that they are more walkable and they're more inviting. All your necessities are in walking distance, co-founder of planning firm Robert Day, Mike Day, said. Two of the world's most densely populated cities were those that managed to contain the spread of the virus very successfully, managing director of EG Urban Planning said. Hong Kong and Singapore have densities that are orders of magnitude greater than Sydney, which is 407 people per square kilometre. These are cities in the 3,000 and 4,000 people per square kilometre range, depending on how you measure the metropolitan area. And he said Australia's low density was a problem, particularly for those in the outer suburbs of our biggest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, who faced long commute times and lack of access to public transport. Public transport cannot work without density. The low density city models also have a terrible effect on pollution, on sprawl, on car dependency. Cities are essential to the functioning of society, and dense cities are the most functional, active, vibrant, and successful forms of human agglomeration. Dense cities also provide more opportunities for people to walk and cycle daily, and therefore give them better overall health outcomes, RMIT University's distinguished professor and planning expert Billy Giles Corti said. The way we design our cities makes a huge difference, so a denser city means that we do have all the benefits of density, access to public transport, the potential for more affordable housing, people can walk and cycle to local shops. Oh, please, 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 no more rubbish from the real estate sectors, as those locked up in small, poorly noise-insulated high-rise units will attest. The high-rise phenomenon is an icon of poor quality, high-density profiteering. It is not necessary, and it does not offer higher quality of life, at least not from our surveys. Watch the relative movement of high-rise and low-rise property prices in the months ahead. Mind you, getting any type of mortgage appears to be getting more difficult. The mortgage broking industry, as represented by the MFAA, has raised concerns about the treatment of borrowers, particularly those who are Australian home buyers who may have been granted an unconditional approval on their mortgage, but has since seen a change in their working hours or job security. The MFAA CEO noted that the MFAA was consulting with lenders and the Australian Banking Association regarding this evolving issue, but said that the association's view was that despite the complexity of the issue, there was a form of pre-settlement hardship. We had a number of discussions with lenders and the ABA, and it seems that some lenders are adopting the approach of doing what is in the customer's best interest in the circumstances. So they are having that discussion with the customer as to whether they wish to proceed or are required to proceed in terms of an enforceable contract, and then, if necessary, settling that loan in accordance with the original unconditional approval. And they added, there are 3 points that brokers need to bear in mind should such a situation occur. Firstly, brokers have an obligation to notify lenders if they're aware that their client's circumstances have changed between the unconditional approval and settlement. Second, some lenders' contracts may include clauses that allow the lenders to reevaluate and withdraw their pre-approval if there's been a material change in the customer's circumstances. And third, brokers will need to undertake a full responsible lending assessment if their customers ask them further advice on whether they should proceed with settlement if their circumstances have changed since the original credit assistance was provided. We do know that several lenders have already begun challenging their risk appetite, and some are also telling the broker channel that they will be reviewing their existing pipeline of credit applications, including those that have been previously approved, to understand whether a borrower's circumstance has fundamentally changed to such an extent that their credit profile or the loan security or borrower has been altered. And as our property insider Edwin Almeida said yesterday, valuers are also downing their valuations. So the lending equation for new loans is, I think, pretty much stalled. Also today, Westpac put out an announcement to say that they expected new and increased provisions, excluding impairment provisions and asset write-downs, totaling $1.4 billion, which will reduce first half 2020 cash earnings and statutory net profit. But no, this is not COVID-related. They said following the $2.8 billion of capital raising, around 63 basis points to the CET1 capital ratio, raised in the half, and payment of the final 2019 dividend, Westpac CET1 capital ratio was 10.8% as at 31st of December 2019. The impact of the items disclosed today on Westpac CET1 capital ratio is estimated to be around 30 basis points, noting that some items have no impact on capital as they are already capital deductions. These items, along with their cash earnings impact, include provisions and costs associated with the AUSTRAC proceedings and response plans of just over $1 billion after tax, an increase for provisions for customer refunds, repayments and litigation around $260 million after tax, a reduction in the value of several assets costing around $70 million after tax, and costs of changes in the provision of group life insurance of around $70 million after tax. You could say this is all the new CEO putting out the trash. And they're still working on the first half 20 impairment charges in anticipation of credit losses that it expects to incur from the virus outbreak. And Westpac plans to update the market once this impairment charge has been finalised and prior to the announcement of its first half results on the 4th of May 2020. And I think we're going to see a lot more bad news from the banks as they disclose more are the hits that they're going to take. And finally, as JP Morgan wrote over the weekend, there is a growing narrative in the markets that the end of the crisis is in sight. By some accounts, countries are bending the cases curve, allowing a relatively quick reversal of social distancing policies and a V-shaped recovery in the global economy. In sum, it is time to look through the dark hours ahead and focus on the approaching dawn. They said, well, we agree with part of this narrative, but disagree with the bottom line. It does appear that a number of countries and regions are starting to bend the curve. The growth in cases has slowed significantly in most of the euro area, and the biggest hotspot in the US, New York, is showing hints of slowing. Areas that shut down early, like Austria, are now debating what to reopen. Of course, the number of deaths will lag, and that ugly reality will be with us longer. But, they say, unfortunately, we're also getting more information on what a reopening looks like and the dangers of premature re-engagement. China, with its authoritarian controls on population movement, has opened up significantly in the past 6 weeks or so, and now is roughly at 80% of capacity by some metrics. However, a number of other countries have found it hard to completely reopen their economy, even with a much better pandemic health system than in Europe and the US. In addition, they say, in our view, V-shaped optimists have forgotten the basic lesson of the business cycle. Recessions can be triggered by a variety of shock surging oil prices, central bank inflation fighting popping bubbles, and now a health crisis. But the recession continues well after the initial shock fades. This is because the drop in activity triggers a nasty feedback loop in the economy that overwhelms the policy easing. A 2 or 3 month shutdown, they say, will leave lasting scars on confidence. Economies will reopen to a greatly diminished demand environment with high savings rates and very low discretionary spending. This, they say, argues for a U-shaped recovery and a persistent large output gap, in our view. And to underscore that, the latest US data on forward-looking revenue prospects from companies, shown by Goldman Sachs, shows a significant fall in expectations, which goes back to my main point. No one knows how this is going to play out, but as more data comes out, initial bullish projections are turning to water. This health and financial crisis has a long way to run as yet. As they sometimes say, you can have a crisis by going down an escalator, but the recovery takes a lot longer because you have to climb up the stairs. And typically this can take 4 or 5 times as long as the initial fall. And before I go, a quick alert. I've been asked about the mortgage stress data for March. I discussed this in our last live stream event, but I will make a short separate video, as I've had several requests for this information in a separate neat package. I have to tell you, the mortgage stress data is worryingly relevant now, so it's worth making sure that you're across that too. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.